last session, we had been going through the claim of Sunni scholars who say that Imam Mahdi ajallaha ta'ala faraja belongs to the lineage of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam, not the Imam Hassan Askari alayhi salam. Now for that, they had so many narrations, and in the previous session, we tried to analyze those narrations in terms of chain. Now today, we'll continue the session and analyze the same narrations in terms of content. And on that note, we have with us Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Very warm welcome. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for giving us so much information, coming up with the narrations, their chains, and then analyzing them. And now I want you to analyze the same narrations in terms of content for our listeners.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, there are not too many narrations in this regard. It's only one narration mentioned by Abu Dawud Sajastani. And inshallah, we'll refer to the fact that many other narrations, even in Sunni sources, they prove that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is from the lineage of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So it's only one narration.
Okay.
Now, we talked about this one narration and we said that it's not an authentic narration in terms of the chain. But what about the content? Let me read quickly the narration again. According to this narration, Imam Ali alayhi salam nazara ila ibnihi al-Hasan, looked at his son al-Hasan. And then he says that this son of mine is a master, as he was named by the Prophet. And there will come from his lineage a man whose name is like the name of your Prophet, that is Muhammad. He is like the Prophet in terms of manners and character, but not like the Prophet in terms of the physical features. And he will fill the earth with justice. Now, the second point is that the same narration has been mentioned by some Sunni scholars, but in these books, instead of Nazara ila ibnihi al-Hasan, we have the phrase Nazara ila ibnihi al-Husayn. So, as you see, this is completely in line with many other narrations in both Shia and Sunni sources. And the rest of the narration is the same. It doesn't make any difference. So, for example, let me just share with you one Sunni narration in this regard, one Sunni source. And that is Asna al-Matalib by Shamsuddin al-Jazari al-Shafi'i. He talks about the fact that whether Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is from the lineage of Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam or Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And finally he comes to this conclusion and he says, وَالْأَسَحْ أَنَّكُمْ مِنْ ذُرِّيَّةِ الْحُسَيْنِ ابْنَ عَلِي. The more authentic point and viewpoint is that he is from the lineage and offspring of Husayn ibn Ali alayhi salam, because of the fact that we have a very explicit narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam. And now, here he is referring to the same narration, but the point is that here we read, قال علي عليه السلام ونظر إلى ابنه الحسين. Imam alayhi salam looked at his son Hussein, and then he said that this son of mine is a master, as he was named by the Prophet, and the rest of the narration is just like that narration.
Same.
Exactly.
But now, it only differs who Imam Ali alayhi salam looked at.
Exactly.
All right.
And it's a matter of those people who maybe quoted the narration or, written down the narrations. There might be a mistake in writing down Hassan and Hussein. But the point is that the same
other
narration,
other features were same.
So the point is that even one this narration that some, especially Wahhabi scholars, they have argued to claim that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is from the lineage of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the same narration has been mentioned in some other Sunni sources, but in that version we have Ibnihi al-Hussein. Imam Ali alayhi salam looked at his son al-Hussein and said that Mahdi is from the lineage of al-Hussein alayhi salam. So this is the second point.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old pain. The more
The third point is that it's very somehow strange that why Ibn Taymiyyah has paid attention only to one this narration and has ignored many other narrations in Sunni sources which refer to the fact that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is from the offspring of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We have many narrations in this regard. For example, some of these narrations are quoted by Maqdisi al-Shafi'i in Aqd al-Durar and Muhibbuddin al-Tabari in the Khair al-Uqba. For example, according to Hudhaifa, he says that one day the Holy Prophet was delivering a sermon for us, and then he talked about the end of the times, and he said the following. He said that if there remains only one day from this world, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will prolong it so much so that a person from my offspring will have a kind of uprising among my nation. His name is like my name. Then according to this narration, Salman, the famous companion of the Prophet, he stood up and said, Ya Rasulullah min ayyi wallik, O Prophet of God, that person belongs to whom? From which of your children? And according to this narration, the Holy Prophet said, Huwa min waladi hada wa daraba biyadiki ala al-Husayn alayhi salam. The Holy Prophet put his hand on Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. He said that he will be from this son of mine, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So this narration is very explicit in saying that according to the Holy Prophet, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is from the lineage of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. This is one narration.
And there are all Sunni sources.
Yeah,
and
I'm just quoting.
Hadith, yeah.
Exactly. I'm just quoting from Sunni sources.
This is interesting, like this Ibn Taymiyyah that you mentioned, one of the very famous Wahhabi scholars, is just trying to stretch only one narration, and that too in terms of content we saw was mentioned at so many places, but at different places. It's either written Imam Hassan, and at some places it's written Imam Hussein. But the rest of the features, like you said, Imam Ali alayhi salam looked at one of his sons and he said they are the masters of youth of the paradise. And then they will be looking, I'll be having a son among them who will be in manners and character relating to Prophet, and he'll not relate to him. Resemble him in terms of physical features and fill earth with justice. We saw all these characters being repeated. However, there was only difference in name. The name was also in the Sunni narrations.
Many other narrations in Sunni sources from the Prophet, they put emphasis on the fact that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is from the offspring of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Like this one that I quoted from Maqdisi al-Shafi'i in Aqd al-Durar fi Akhbar al-Muntazar. Volume 1, page 83, and also Muhibbuddin al-Tabari in the Khair al-Uqba, volume 1, page 137. There are many other narrations, like, let me just share other narrations. The other narration is from other companions of the Prophet. For example, Abdullah ibn Amr says that the Holy Prophet said the following, يَخْرَجُ رَجُلٌ مِّن وُدِّ الْحُسَيْنِ مِّن قِبَلِ الْمَشْرِقِ. From the east, a man from the generation of Hussein alayhi salam, he will come. He will have a kind of uprising. And he will destroy his enemies, even if they are as firm as the mountains. So again, another narration from another companion of the Prophet, but referring to the same point, that Imam
uprising,
Mahdi alayhi salam is from the generation of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and not Imam Hassan alayhi salam. This has been mentioned, for example, by Marwazi, Kitab al-Fitan, volume 1, page 371. As-Suyuti, the famous Sunni scholar, in Al-Hawi, volume 2, page 62, and many other Sunni scholars. Again, another Sunni scholar is Ibn Sabbagh Maliki. He has a rather long narration about, from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. And in that narration, again, it's been mentioned that the Holy Prophet would put his holy hand on Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Dr. Karimi, I'll be talking to you here. We need to take a short break. The listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Addressing Fatima to Zahra Saramullah alayha, the Holy Prophet said the following, O Fatima, so the hand of the Prophet is on the shoulder of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, according to this narration. And addressing his beloved daughter, Fatima to Zahra Saramullah alayha, the Holy Prophet said the following, O Fatima, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us the Ahlul Bayt six features which are unique for us, and no one else would be given any of these features in future, and no one has been given any of these features in the past. Then the Holy Prophet explains these features. Our Prophet, that is referring to himself, is the best among all the Prophets, that is your father. Our Wasi, our vicegerent, is the best of the vicegerents, and that is your husband, referring to Imam Ali alayhi salam. Our martyr, our shaheed, is the best of the shuhada, and that is your uncle Hamza. From us is a man who in paradise, he will have two wings, and referring to Ja'far ibn Abi Talib, who is, according to some narrations, spiritually speaking, he will have two wings. And from us are two children who are two sons of you, that is Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and no one is like them. And finally, the Holy Prophet said, the last feature is that Mahdi of this nation is from us. And that is the one that Isa ibn Maryam will come and say prayers behind him. And then the Holy Prophet put his hand on the shoulder of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and said that Mahdi is from his generation and his lineage. This narration has been mentioned, as I mentioned, by Ibn Sabbagh al-Maliki in Al-Fusul al-Muhimma, volume 2, page 1114. Also, Qunduzi al-Hanafi in Yanabi'u al-Mawadda, and many other Sunni scholars. So again, as you rightly mentioned, Ibn Taymiyyah has ignored all these narrations and only has referred to one narration, which is weak in terms of the chain. Just let me share one more narration in this regard. Another narration is mentioned by Maqlisi al-Shafi'i, and in his book of hadith, that is Aqd al-Durar fi Akhbar al-Muntazar, volume 1, page 157, he is quoting one narration from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. So it's not weird, because at the end of the day, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is one of the Ahlul Bayt, and he was highly regarded by the Sunni scholars as well. So in this narration, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, addressing Jabir ibn Yazid, says that, O Jabir, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will gather the companions of Mahdi, who are 313 people together, and they will pay allegiance to Mahdi between Rukn and Maqam, which are two holy places around the Kaaba. And then he says that, O Jabir, wal Mahdi rajulun min wuld al-Husayn. Mahdi is a man from the generation of al-Husayn, that is Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So all these narrations prove the fact that, first of all, the number of the narrations in Sunni sources which refer to the fact that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is the son of Imam Hussein alayhi salam outnumber the narration which claims that he's from the generation of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. Second of all, that one narration is weak in terms of the chain. And third of all, even that one narration has two versions, Al-Hassan and Al-Hussein alayhi salam. So to claim that because of only this one weak narration, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is from the generation of Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam is not a firm claim.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for clearing the concept. You cleared all that using the Sunni sources only. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A new report released by Iran's Nur News website on Monday says undercover Israeli military personnel deployed to U.S. bases in the region are conducted their own missions independent of American forces present in those bases. The report says the important point about regional presence is the deployment of undercover military and intelligence agents of Israel in some regional countries that enjoy close relations with Iran. Experts believe that the main goal behind the presence of the Israeli agents in some regional countries is to spy on and collect direct information related to Iran's important bases and sensitive facilities.
It's a very dangerous precedent. What we now know is that the IDF and the Zionist regime's different intelligence units like Mossad are working within Central Command, are working alongside U.S. Forces, NATO forces, and their allies, the Gulf states in the region. And they are their main focus is to control what's going on in the region and ultimately to fight against Iran. And this is a dangerous escalation. And we've seen it now over the past few years, first with the United States removal from the JCPOA, the brutal assassination of General Soleimani, and the increasing hawkish nature of U.S. foreign policy.
The report notes that although the Iranian armed forces are closely monitoring these provocative moves, for which the host countries are also responsible, the nature of these actions will increase tension and instability in the region and can lead to unpredictable conditions. It added that high-resolution documented photos are available on the presence of Israeli regime's aircraft and espionage equipment in the U.S. bases in some regional countries, which confirmed the intelligence gathered in the field on Israel's anti-Iran activities in the region. According to the new report, senior officials of countries where Israeli undercover experts have been present have been aware of the Israeli military and intelligence presence in their countries, but prefer to keep silent. The project started when Israel was transferred from the United States European Command, EUCOM, to U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, in order to enable the Tel Aviv regime to carry out its intelligence and military conspiracies in West Asia following the withdrawal of the United States from the region. While some believe the normalization of ties between some Arab states and Israel has laid the groundwork for and provided Tel Aviv with a pretext to conduct its operations close to Iranian borders, others say the U.S. is assigning tasks to Israel to carry out in its stead in the region.
Their main focus is on Iran, and they are having in the region allies like Arab Gulf states and others who are focused on this. And secondly, it's to help the United States, who sees China as a threat because China and Iran's close ties, and now their alliance is a threat to U.S. Zionist stability and their control in the region. So I think that what we see here is the move to Central Command is primarily against Iran, but also undergirding that from the United States is Iran's relationship with China.
Iran has shown that it won't stand idly by in the face of foreign aggression. The January 2020 attack on the Ain al-Assad air base in Iraq housing U.S. troops is one example. Iran carried out the retaliatory missile attack in the aftermath of the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and Iraq's deputy commander of the Popular Mobilization Unit, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in Baghdad. Iranian officials have, on so many occasions, noted that the Islamic Republic won't tolerate the presence of Israel in the region, highlighting the threats that the Israeli regime poses to the regional nations. Will they heed the warnings? Only time can tell.
Al-Hawl camp is located 15 kilometers away from the Syrian-Iraqi border. It is the largest camp of Daesh elements and is controlled by the U.S.-affiliated Syrian Democratic Forces. The militants are holding tens of thousands of people in Al-Hawl camp, East Hasaka City. They run it in cooperation with U.S. occupation forces, including thousands of Daesh terrorists of different nationalities and their families, whom Washington invests and employs to implement its plans in the region. Meanwhile, Iraq's National Security Advisor, Qasem al-Araji, has expressed concern about the possibility of the release of Daesh elements and leaders from prisons controlled by U.S.-backed Kurdish militants in eastern Syria. He says Daesh has made numerous attempts to break such prisons since most of the terrorist group's leaders are incarcerated there. He has frequently met with U.S. officials and United Nations envoys to stress the need to resolve the issue of the Al-Hawl refugee camp in the northeastern Syrian province of Hasaka. The senior Iraqi official called on foreign governments to repatriate their citizens from Al-Hawl and urged a rapid dismantlement of the camp. Daesh began a terror campaign in Iraq in 2014, overrunning vast swathes in lightning attacks. Iraq declared victory over Daesh in December 2017 after a three-year counter-terrorism military campaign, which also had the support of neighboring Iran. The remnants, though, keep staging sporadic attacks across Iraq, attempting to regroup and unleash fresh violence. Daesh has intensified its terrorist attacks in Iraq since January 2020, when the United States assassinated top Iranian anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and deputy commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, near Baghdad International Airport. The Iraqi anti-terror resistance groups have repeatedly warned Baghdad that the remnants of Daesh active in Syria's U.S.-occupied east may find unhindered access to the Iraqi border and infiltrate into its western Anbar province. This is while the positions of the PMU and its affiliated resistance groups operating against Daesh in the border regions have repeatedly come under attack by the U.S. military over the past years.
The United States funnels money into these groups, into these very kind of ethno-nationalist and separatist organizations that are against the current government of, in this case, Syria. And of course, the government of Syria happens to be very anti-U.S., so naturally, the United States is going to fund groups that want to topple the government of a given country that opposes NATO, that opposes to the West, that opposes U.S. dominance.
The U.S. military has stationed forces and military equipment in eastern and northeastern Syria, with the Pentagon claiming that the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the area from falling into the hands of Daesh terrorists. Damascus, however, says the unlawful deployment is meant to plunder the country's resources. Former U.S. President Donald Trump admitted on several occasions that American forces were in Syria for its oil. Additionally, security conditions have been deteriorating in the areas under the control of U.S.-backed Kurdish militants in Syria's northern and northeastern provinces of Raqqa, Hasaka, and Deir ez-Zor.
The Assads, Hafez and Bashar al-Assad, who have been the last two presidents of Syria have not allowed the United States or the corporations of the West to come into the country and buy up the oil companies, and began allowing Shell and British Petroleum and the other major oil monopolies to come into Syria and to steal the natural resources that rightly belong to the Syrian nation, to the Syrian government and their people. And so as a result, the United States has decided, with the backing of NATO and Western European powers, that the only option at this point is either a full invasion of Syria to topple the Assad government, which would be absolutely disastrous and have horrible repercussions for the United States and the West on a geopolitical scale.
Local Syrians complain that U.S.-backed militants' constant raids have generated a state of frustration and instability, severely affecting their businesses and livelihood. Residents accuse the U.S.-sponsored militants of stealing crude oil. Local council affiliated with the militants also stand accused of financial corruption. France's 2022 presidential vote is divided into two rounds, a free-for-all and a runoff vote between the top two contenders. 12 candidates, ranging from the far right to the far left, are running for this election. If a candidate secures over half of the total vote, they will directly win the election, but this hasn't happened since Charles de Gaulle's re-election in 1965. Otherwise, only the top two candidates make it through to the second round, and whoever wins that round will be the new French president for a five-year term. President Emmanuel Macron is seeking to become the first incumbent to win re-election since Jacques Chirac in 2002. He is vowing to continue to decrease taxes, raise the pension age to 65, and get France to full employment after decades of mass joblessness. But Macron entered the race late, and his second term is facing a real threat from far-right candidate Marine Le Pen, as polls show a closing of the gap between the incumbent and his main rival. Le Pen was the runner-up in the 2017 elections. This will be her third attempt at the presidency. She's a key far-right figure and the daughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen, who founded France's National Front and is notorious for his racist, anti-immigrant views. Le Pen has focused on the cost of living crisis, while her anti-immigration program would ban the Muslim headscarf from all public places. Voters have complained of a lack of new political ideas or vision, and few solutions to their problems, including purchasing power and the high cost of living, healthcare, and the fight against climate change. There have been fewer rallies, and voters have complained there was no direct TV debate between all candidates. As a result, an unprecedented number of French voters say they are unsure who to vote for, particularly young and low-income voters. Voter turnout has decreased from 84% in 2007 to about 78% in 2017, and it is believed that abstention may be even higher this time. A low turnout could have a major impact on the vote. France's 2022 presidential election is unlike the previous ones. That's mainly due to the events that have taken place in the political and social scene of France in recent years and intensified the pressure on minorities such as Muslims and immigrants. For Muslims, the election of Emmanuel Macron was supposed to provide relief after 5 years of François Hollande. However, Macron's first term has been gloomy for French Muslims. Many French Muslims no longer see him as the centrist that he claimed to be in 2017, particularly due to the adoption of the separatism law in the summer of 2021. The government claims its legislation is intended to strengthen France's secular system. Critics, however, say it unfairly singles out the Muslim community and restricts religious freedom. France has been criticized by international organizations and NGOs, especially the UN, for targeting and marginalizing Muslims with the law. Since February 2018, France has controlled nearly 25,000 mosques, schools, associations, and workplaces and closed 718 of them, including over 20 mosques.
And France, like many other European and Western nations, is going through ever-increasing Islamophobia and environment of hate against Muslims. And the reality is that this environment is escalating by politicians and by media and by the policies of otherization, i.e. targeting Muslims as the reason and the problems for everything whatsoever.
The alleged centrist Macron has no solution for France's anti-Muslim problems. And in case far-right Le Pen replaces him, things are probably not going to change for the better. Therefore, French Muslims have a choice to make: abstention or taking a chance on a left candidate.
Tel Aviv has been the scene of yet another Palestinian operation. On Thursday, a Palestinian man opened fire at Israelis in the heart of a city, killing three and injuring eight others. He was shot dead by Israeli forces after a nine-hour manhunt. Palestinian resistance groups praised the attack as a heroic operation, calling it a natural response to Israeli crimes. The Popular Resistance Committee, a coalition of a number of armed Palestinian groups, says the operation exposed the regime's fragility and weakness. The comments were echoed by Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah, which hailed the recent shooting operation in Tel Aviv as a legitimate response to crimes committed by the Israeli regime. Thursday's attack was the fourth such operation in the past 2 weeks. Late last month, a Palestinian shooting operation killed five people in a Tel Aviv suburb. Attacks in the northern city of Hadera and the southern city of Beersheba had killed six Israelis days earlier. But the question is, what's behind the uptick in the number of attacks that's been described as one of the deadliest waves of Palestinian operations in years?
We are suffering daily from their homes being confiscated, their lives being taken, children being arrested on an almost daily basis and taken off the jail. So for every action, there is a reaction, and repression builds resistance. So I think we are seeing an outcry of despair, but also a strengthening of resistance against the continued illegal occupation of the West Bank.
As tensions mount in the occupied territories, Israel is bracing for more Palestinian operations in the days to come. The events that are unfolding in the occupied territories are reminiscent of hostilities that culminated in the 11-day war on Gaza in May last year, during which over 250 Palestinians, including scores of women and children, were killed in the besieged enclave. The international community called for an immediate end to the war, but stopped short of condemning Israel for the deadly and devastating onslaught after it was over. The world also seems to have turned a blind eye to Israel's land grab and expansionist policies that see hundreds of Palestinian-owned structures razed to the ground every year. The years-long blockade on Gaza Strip, settlers' violence against Palestinians, and Israel's illegal settlement construction activities also seem to be going unnoticed. When some Arab states announced the normalization of ties with Israel, they claimed that their moves will help the Palestinian cause. But the events of the past couple of years have shown that the only contribution their newly established ties with Tel Aviv made to Palestinians has been even more suffering.
You've mentioned all the usual suspects who give political coverage and the fig leaf of respectability to the apartheid Israeli regime, remembering that Israel is a white colonial European colonization project within the Middle East. But you've left out the other group of people, the other organization that have condemned Palestinian violence, but have not condemned Israeli violence, and that is the Palestinian Authority, which is led by the unelected Mahmoud Abbas. So while all these other people are held to account for their failure to hold to account is really apartheid atrocities and war crimes, let us not forget the PA and Mahmoud Abbas.
In the absence of any accountability, Israel is expected to put even more pressure on the people of Palestine. But the Palestinians are indicating that they remain steadfast to keep fighting against the Israeli occupation with or without international support.
In the limelight.
Our data show that global emissions continue to move in the wrong direction at a rapid pace. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA Administrator Rick Spinard said in a statement, adding, "The evidence is consistent, alarming, and undeniable." Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, NOAA says atmospheric methane levels set new record in 2021. Stay tuned for more. Climate scientists have recently stressed the need for urgent action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions following new data showing a record increase in atmospheric methane levels for a second consecutive year. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA Administrator Rick Spinard said in a statement, "Our data show that global emissions continue to move in the wrong direction at a rapid pace. The evidence is consistent, alarming, and undeniable." As NOAA notes, carbon dioxide remains the biggest climate change threat. However, scientists say that reducing methane emissions, the largest anthropogenic sources of which are animal agriculture and energy production, is relatively easy. Spinard said that reducing methane emissions is an important tool we can use right now to lessen the impacts of climate change in the near term and rapidly reduce the rate of warming. Let's not forget that methane also contributes to ground-level ozone formation, which causes roughly 500,000 premature deaths each year around the world. Casey Siegel, director of the Center for Biological Diversity's Climate Law Institute, said that this report is especially alarming because if carbon dioxide is the fossil fuel broiler of our heating planet, methane is a blowtorch with 87 times more short-term heating power. Yet despite methane reductions being a relatively cheap and easy way to get phenomenal climate benefits, the industry has fought regulations at every turn. Polluters' records profits must be used to properly seal and remediate every well and fix every methane leak, she added. But methane reductions have to be one part of a transformative global effort to phase out deadly fossil fuels in favor of truly clean, renewable energy. Anything less puts us on a catastrophic path to an unrecognizable world. According to NOAA, preliminary analysis showed the annual increase in atmospheric methane during 2021 was 17 parts per billion, the largest annual increase recorded since systematic measurements began in 1983. The increase during 2020 was 15.3 ppb. Atmospheric methane levels averaged 1,895.7 ppb during 2021, or around 162% greater than pre-industrial levels. From NOAA's observations, scientists estimate global methane emissions in 2021 are 15% higher than the 1984 to 2006 period. Meanwhile, levels of carbon dioxide also continue to increase at historically high levels. The global surface average for carbon dioxide during 2021 was 414.7 parts per million, which is an increase of 2.66 ppm over the 2020 average. This marks the 10th consecutive year that carbon dioxide increased by more than 2 parts per million, which represents the fastest sustained rate of increase in 63 years since monitoring began. Scientists fear soaring concentrations of methane, which is up to 87 times more potent than CO2 over a 20-year period, may have triggered a potentially irreversible climate feed loop. Critics call the 30% target a step in the right direction, but insufficient to adequately address the emissions crisis. The International Energy Agency said last October that a 75% reduction in methane emissions by 2030 is essential to combating the climate emergency. Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Floating solar panels help landowners benefit from underused body of water. Now, a German company is covering 14,000 square meters of a lake with these panels, turning it into the biggest solar park in the country. The park is built by a family-owned company called Quartzwerk, which specializes in extracting and processing industrial minerals. The company says it wants to become independent of fossil energy sources amid rising energy prices. The head of the Floating Panel Corporation says they will be generating around 3 million kilowatts per hour of green electricity on the surfaces of Limmersheim Lake in southern Germany.
The plant can make a super big contribution to the land-neutral energy transition, because here an unused lake that was previously used for gravel extraction is being converted into a power plant for renewable energy.
Installation and maintenance of the panels are easy and safe, while they also offer a significant reduction in evaporation from the water surface. According to the company, this will save around 1,100 tons of carbon dioxide each year.
A restaurant in the Indonesian capital of Jakarta is taking fine dining to new heights, literally and figuratively, by giving diners a one-of-a-kind experience 50 meters above ground. The restaurant is called Lounge in the Sky. Diners are securely strapped into seats fixed to a table and are hoisted into the air using a heavy-duty lift. First, the gourmet meals are prepared in the main kitchen. Then, the food is loaded onto the platform where the dishes are plated and served to the patrons. The suspended guests are able to take advantage of breathtaking views as they gently rotate at great heights.
At first, it was not easy. I was nervous that I wouldn't be able to swallow the food, let alone drink. But after some time, I could eventually eat. It was thrilling.
While enjoying the meals, the guests use seat belts and the accompanying staff are equipped with safety harnesses. The guests are also briefed on safety regulations before the platform is raised. Diners call the one-hour experience exhilarating and worth the high price. The project developers say the restaurant was aimed at reviving local and international tourism sector after a big slump during the COVID-19 pandemic. The culinary experience is a first in Indonesia and the third in the world after Belgium and Malaysia.
South Koreans are getting outside to enjoy the open air with a local cherry blossom festival in central Seoul. This is while the country has been dealing with an ongoing surge of the Omicron variant of COVID-19. With some performances and the beauty of spring, many people look forward to turning the corner on the pandemic. Frank Smith has a story.
Spring has come to South Korea, and the cherry blossoms are blooming. COVID-19 restrictions on gatherings are finally being eased, and at Ansan Park in central Seoul, a small festival is bringing everyone back out.
I first came here with my friends 4 years ago, but we couldn't come for the past 2 years because of COVID. I was impressed to see so many people no longer being overly careful about COVID, and we're also very happy to be able to attend festivals like this one.
South Koreans have been quite diligent in observing social distancing guidelines and wearing masks. The Omicron variant of COVID-19 has been quite severe here, with cases only recently declining below 200,000 per day. Still, the government's decided to open up. From the open-air stage, Noah Ram and his band entertain a crowd that's anxious to finally get outside and enjoy group activities.
Ever since COVID, and particularly for the entirety of 2021, when the pandemic was at its peak, I have been unable to perform. I felt today was a restart. Spring has come, the weather's great, the blossoms beautiful, and I felt all of this was celebrating today's show.
South Korea's vaccination rate is nearly 90%, with children now getting the jab.
At first, I was very scared of COVID as I felt it was life-threatening. But now I feel okay with it because I consider it an experience and a certain reality. Also, I worry less because of the vaccines and the new medications.
The cherry blossoms blooming has been tracked from Jeju Island in the south and up to the capital as warm weather moved north. And with this change in seasons, attitudes toward life with COVID are changing as well. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The first all-private space crew has successfully docked at International Space Station after spending over 20 hours en route. Three paying customers and a former NASA astronaut will spend 10 days aboard the ISS. The tourists will participate in scientific research, including stem cell experiments and exploring how the body ages in space. The civilian crew were launched into space in a SpaceX rocket from the Kennedy Space Center on Friday. The trip was brokered by Axiom Space, which is the U.S.-based startup that coordinates rocket rides and provides necessary training. It's not the first time paying customers have visited the ISS. Russia sold seats on a Soyuz spacecraft last year. But this is the first mission that includes a crew entirely comprised of civilians.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A new selfie museum in Sweden is flipping the script by making visitors both the artist and the exhibit. The establishment is dubbed the Museum and is in a shopping mall in Stockholm. Unlike other selfie museums, this one has no works of art on its walls. Instead, its brightly decorated rooms are meant to serve as fun backgrounds for visitors to take their selfies or shoot videos in. Other rooms let the visitors bury themselves in candy-colored foam bricks, strike a pose under neon lights, or sit on a huge colorful swing. The manager says the museum is interactive and lets the visitors be the artists themselves in order to create the art they want to see. The Drone Show Korea 2022 has been held at the Busan Exhibition and Convention Center, BEXCO. It featured 137 companies and 533 booths, making this year's incarnation the largest in the show's six-year history. The event also featured the participation of a large international industry representatives from Japan and Western Europe. A highlight of this year's event was military technology centered around the unveiling of new indigenous UAVs. This year's show marked a long-endurance liquid hydrogen drone produced by a South Korean company. These developments reflect South Korea's attempt to improve resilience and revolutionize its approach to warfare. The event puts on display the importance of drone industry in various spheres, including defense purposes. More than 163 wildlife species have been released back into lagoons and forests in Colombia's Casanare province after being seized and rehabilitated by authorities fighting wildlife trafficking. These include 15 different species such as anteaters, turtles, macaws, a toucan, and a leopard. They were nurtured back to health by fauna vets from an environmental authority in charge of managing sustainable development. The authority, Corporinoquia, released more than 1,200 animals back into the wild in 2021 alone. Colombia is one of the world's most biodiverse countries by square kilometer and is home to some 10% of the world's flora and fauna.
A super rare birth has added a cute member to critically endangered Sumatran rhinos of Indonesia. The newborn calf is the sixth born since intensive efforts to breed the species began in the 1980s. The female calf, which doesn't have a name yet, was given birth to by a rhino named Rosa in a sanctuary. Rosa has suffered eight miscarriages since 2005 when she was brought in from the wild for a breeding program. Fewer than 80 Sumatran rhinos remain in the world, mainly on the Indonesian islands of Sumatra and Borneo. Excessive poaching along with other threats has brought the species to the brink of extinction.
With neon lights on the floor and walls, pulsing electronic beats, and a glowing red shuttlecock bouncing back and forth, Malaysian badminton court evokes a sci-fi movie set. Shuttle in the Dark is a badminton hall in the iconic Petronas Twin Towers in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. It was set up in late 2021 by a sport management company to encourage people to take up the racket sport after 2 years of social restrictions because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Director of INEC Sport Management says the initial goal was to draw sports fans and players back into action.
Our initial goal was how can we encourage and gain back the interest of people to come back and play. And not only those enthusiasts, but then as well the new people who was not able to or never play badminton before. So that's why we come out with this experience called Shuttle in the Dark.
Playing on a futuristic court presents an unusual challenge for athletes as they have to adjust their eyes to the darkness to fly. Badminton is one of the most popular sports in Malaysia and Asia, with a thriving community in the Southeast Asian community. It has produced some of the world's top-ranked players. A zoo in Ireland's capital, Dublin, has unveiled its newest habitat called the Himalayan Hills, a brand new home of the red panda and the snow leopard. Visitors are able to see the red panda's habitat by traveling along the new trail around a rocky edge to an open viewing area. The red pandas are typically climbing, exploring, or munching on bamboo at the top of broad-leafed evergreen trees. The expanded habitat was designed with a red panda's tree-dwelling lifestyle in mind. Also, visitors can gaze up at the 15-meter rocky slope through an impressive panoramic viewing area to spot the snow leopards. These elusive felines are typically nocturnal, so catching a glimpse of one is a rare treat.
Yeah, the animals are settling in well. We've tried to recreate the wild habitats in the Himalayan hills. Both species live quite high up. In case of the snow leopards, up to 5,000 meters on these very steep rocky slopes, which you can see here in the habitat as well. We've tried to use the topology of Dublin Zoo.
The project took a few years to complete. It was halted in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic and massive budget shortages, but was restarted after government funding in 2021. The zoo is part of a protection project for red pandas and snow leopards. These animals are listed as vulnerable due to threats from poaching and severe habitat loss. Ancient Pompeii has a new guardian, Spot, a four-legged robot dog that will inspect the ancient Italian city's streets and tunnels to identify structural issues. The robot, designed by the U.S. firm Boston Dynamics, will patrol Pompeii at nighttime. The robot inspects the smallest of spaces and gathers data for planning interventions to fix safety and structural issues. Equipped with a 360-degree camera, Spot will also protect the city's streets from illegal relic hunters who cause structural damage to the ruins by digging tunnels. Pompeii will also have its own eye in the sky, a Leica BLK-2 flying laser scanner capable of autonomously conducting 3D scans of the ruins, helping Spot carry out its tasks. Safeguarding ancient sites from treasure hunters has always been a problem for every country, especially the ancient ones.
IRIB English Radio.